This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Do you remember what you were doing last October 9th? That was the day the Dow finished at its all-time record high. Well, today it closed more than 20% below that mark, which is the classic definition of a bear market. It's a fact that's not really of much use, except maybe for grim party conversation, but it sure doesn't bode well for the banks that simply can't bear much more of this. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday, the second day of July. We've only just begun, and I'm not just talking about the start of the program. In the past few days, one analyst borrowed from Churchill for this assessment of where we stand with the credit crisis. We are not yet at the beginning of the end, but rather at the end of the beginning. Notwithstanding more than $400 billion worth of assets that financial firms have already written off their books, a top analyst with Oppenheimer & Company is now expecting Merrill Lynch and Citigroup to announce billions more in write-downs. So, have they been holding out on us, too afraid to spill the bad news all at once and still breaking it to us slowly? Or are these fresh losses that signal things are really getting worse? Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Not much has gone right for investment firms lately. The stock market is tumbling and all sorts of loans are losing value. Quincy Crosby is chief investment strategist for The Hartford. She says analysts expected write-downs would continue, but that they'd dribble in.
And at some point the market just says, okay, we're toward the end. But the key here was that we expected that perhaps there would be a stabilization in the housing market, and that just simply hasn't turned out to be correct.
But some Wall Street firms aren't being straight with investors, says Christopher Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics. He points to the investment bank's relationship with the bond insurers like MBIA and AmBank. Those companies have been downgraded, he says, and they insure what the banks own.
So a little charade is ongoing. And as long as Wall Street, the sell-side firms, are willing to pretend that the insurance held by AmBank and MBIA is in fact money good, then they can pretend that similar stuff on their books is money good, too.
Whalen says the longer Wall Street plays these games, the worse the damage will eventually be.
The fessing up part, you know, the coming to Jesus, is going to be considerable. You know, I look for second quarter to be nasty, third quarter is going to be nasty.
Some banks have opted to cut their losses and sell their dodgy loans. Whalen says Citigroup is selling $500 billion worth. He says they're going to lose a lot of money, but it's better than holding on. CIT Group, a big fund manager, sold nearly $10 billion of mortgage assets yesterday. The company's stock rose 30% on the news. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
There's yet another chapter in what's beginning to look like an eternal corporate love triangle. Seems Microsoft just can't get past its obsession with Yahoo's search business, at least according to the Wall Street Journal. It reports Microsoft is looking to team up with News Corp or Time Warner to buy Yahoo. They would then bust up the company, with Microsoft keeping the search business. Of course, there's that engagement Yahoo has already made with Google to share ad revenue from online searches. But today, the Justice Department said it's going to take a closer look at that matchup. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has been searching for some answers on just what these companies are looking for.
Earlier this year, Microsoft made a very generous proposal to Yahoo, nearly $48 billion, and Yahoo gave its answer.
Let's not start putting things on this level.
What? This is a good level.
I think that we should spend some time apart.
Microsoft, Yahoo's just not that into you. But Henry Blodgett with Silicon Alley Insider says there's a reason Microsoft can't walk away. It needs Yahoo's search business to stave off Google.
Search has definitely emerged as a business that is every bit as powerful and profitable as Microsoft's Windows monopoly. I do think the company is at a crossroads here that could ultimately destroy it if it doesn't make the transition.
And Microsoft could cash in big if it does. Online advertising is worth about $65 billion right now and growing rapidly. Search accounts for roughly half of that. And at this late point in the game, Microsoft has to buy rather than build its way into the business, says Ken Wilber with USC's Marshall School of Business.
I think it's one of the only shots they have. Once advertisers and consumers form habits with search engines, it's very tough to get them to switch, especially when the products are as good as those currently offered by Google and Yahoo.
Wilber says Microsoft may get its way. Google's proposed deal with Yahoo is being looked at by the Justice Department because of antitrust issues, and many Yahoo shareholders would like to see Microsoft move in. Microsoft won't be able to stay single forever. Wilber points out that Google has rolled out free word processing and spreadsheet applications, a direct challenge to Microsoft's bread-and-butter software business. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The budding local food movement is getting a supersized boost. Walmart has announced plans to get more of the produce it sells from local farms. Its reason? The rising cost of fuel. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Walmart says it's committed to double-digit growth in the amount of local fruits and vegetables it sells at its U.S. supercenters. The retail giant says in the past 2 years it's boosted the number of local farmers it works with by 50%. That means it'll spend about $400 million on local produce this year. But Iowa State agricultural economist Bruce Babcock says Walmart isn't doing it for the local farmers.
With $4.80 diesel, it makes sense from the bottom line to not import and to pay trucking costs of all this food.
Walmart says it's already saved about $1.5 million in fuel costs by selling more of its peaches in the same states it buys them. Michelle Halsell with the University of Arkansas helped Walmart develop its local sourcing plan. And she says the ripple effects extend well beyond the retailer's bottom line.
It creates access. It helps to expand the reach of the program so that more local farmers can get into the game. It also expands the reach of the program so that other buyers, produce buyers, large and small, can also get into the game.
But that expansion could cause growing pains. Babcock says Walmart's definition of local produce isn't the same as that of the local food movement, which promotes small-scale farming and environmental values.
Local to Walmart means it's produced in a state, and it could be produced on a mega farm.
In other words, he says, in the eyes of Walmart, that factory farm down the road is just as local as the family-owned vegetable patch. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Well, we've all been asking the question, how high can oil prices go? For now, the safe answer seems to be even higher. Another day, another record. Crude shot to a new high, over $144 a barrel. That rise followed word from the government that U.S. inventories fell by 2 million barrels last week. The good news is gasoline stocks rose because high prices have cut summer demand. Well, it should be good news, but who really knows when it comes to energy prices these days? Worries about the relentless rise in oil prices had investors growling today. As we mentioned at the top, the bears have officially taken over on Wall Street. We'll have more on that when we do the numbers. We are just learning that one of Leona Helmsley's last wishes was for up to $8 billion of her hotel fortune to go to the dogs in the form of their care and welfare. That's according to a mission statement she left for her charitable trust. Today's New York Times reports the trustees are still trying to figure out how to carry out her wishes. But there are plenty of animal welfare groups that could probably use that money now more than ever. Our own financial wag, Jeremy Hobson, joins us now from Washington with the drooping tail of another offbeat economic indicator. Jeremy, this one sounds a little sad.
That's right, Bob. It's not nearly as pleasant as the lipstick sales indicator we talked about a couple weeks ago. Turns out when the economy tanks, animal shelters start filling up. Some owners just can't afford to care for their pets any longer. I went to the Washington Animal Rescue League to see for myself and spoke with the director there, Gary Weitzman. Now, tell me where we are right now.
We're actually standing in a room with 130 dogs.
Wow.
The fact that we can talk at all is sort of a miracle. They're all just about to get fed, so they're very excited about that. It's one of the highlights of the day.
And all kinds of different dogs in here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you'll see everything. You'll see little Chihuahuas to pit bulls. We've had Great Danes. We had four Mastiffs. And next door we have, who's not in here right now, probably out for a walk, Cedar, a big
pit bull. You're not supposed to say that word, I don't think, amongst all these dogs.
I know. That's true. Don't say walk. Everybody's ears perk up.
What is going on right now in terms of how many animals are being brought in by people?
What we've seen in the last 6 to 9 months is more people having to surrender it for what seem to be economic reasons. We actually also, since we have a full veterinary hospital with four full-time vets, we're going nonstop. It's purely for low-income people. And we've probably increased that by at least 20% just this year.
And give me the timeline of how things have changed, how rapidly things have changed for you.
Well, we see it sort of slowly, not rapidly. It's sort of been insidious in the last, I'd say, 9 months. We are surrounded by a lot of areas that are definitely economically challenged, even in good times. And so this is 10 times worse now because of the economy.
10 times worse.
And even more so, we don't just deal with Washington, D.C. We deal with the entire mid-Atlantic to south coast of the United States. A great many of our dogs are from rural Georgia. And there, it's foreclosure, foreclosure, foreclosure.
And people come in and they say, my house was foreclosed on, I've got to get rid of my dog?
Exactly. We used to see all sorts of reasons. You know, didn't get along with another dog, or someone developed allergies. We don't see that so much now. Now we're saying we can't keep the dog, we can't afford to.
Now, there are no national figures on whether there's been an increase in surrenders, but we did check with some animal shelters around the country, and they are seeing the same thing. One piece of good news, Bob, Gary Weitzman says the shelter here has plenty of room to accommodate the influx, so none of those dogs you heard from are going anywhere unless they are adopted.
So I guess the economy's not exactly going to the dogs. They've got their own troubles. Thanks for alerting us to that, Jeremy.
Sure.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in Washington. Bankers from around the world were about the only ones who paid much attention to a meeting in Basel, Switzerland 20 years ago. It was there that international financial regulators decided banks would be required to keep a certain amount of cash on hand to protect against unexpected losses. If you're wondering why this matters, consider the ongoing credit crunch. Had the banks been required to set aside a bit more capital to fund their risky subprime loans, they might not be suffering from the big losses that we mentioned at the top of the program. Now, U.S. banks are bracing for a new round of requirements known as Basel II. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
At the offices of the Risk Management Association in Philadelphia, Pam Martin hefts a 600-page document onto a table.
Here it is. This is Basel II and the U.S. implementation of Basel II.
Martin is the group's head of regulatory relations, so she's actually read all 600 pages.
Oh, yes, several times.
What those pages say, in a nutshell, is that the more risks a bank takes by lending or investing, the more shareholder money it should have on hand. That way, shareholders take a hit from any losses before the bank's depositors do.
If you have a loan to a company with less risk, you would hold less capital. On the other side of the coin, if you have, say, a subprime mortgage, for instance, you would have to hold a lot more capital.
Under Basel I, banks have to hold certain amounts of capital for loans regardless of their risk. To many, the new Basel II rules seem like a smarter idea now that banks have lost billions of dollars on risky subprime loan investments. And most of the world's banks have adopted the reforms. It could be a year or more before U.S. banks are ready to go. The delay is partly thanks to controversy over the rules. They require banks to follow complicated mathematical models to determine how much capital they need to set aside. Bill Isaac is one of Basel II's fiercest critics. He headed the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation during the banking crisis of the 1980s. Now he's a banking consultant. Isaac says the Basel II models are too complex.
I've been in this business for nearly 40 years, and I don't understand these models. It takes a mathematician. And that is one of my principal objections to the models, is that bank boards of directors and senior management, even senior regulatory people, cannot understand these models.
Then there's the complaint that models helped get us into this mess in the first place. They rely on past data to predict the future. And Isaac says something unforeseen, like home price declines, always comes up. Another criticism is that the regulations rely on credit rating agencies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's to determine how risky a loan is.
And we all have learned the hard lesson about how flawed S&P and other decisions are.
Karen Shaw Petru is managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. She studies the impact of regulations on financial institutions and their customers. Petru says the kinks can be worked out later, but we need Basel II now.
Even with the flaws in the Basel II rules, they need to be put in place quickly and then refined, because the longer we have Basel I, the more risk we have, the less we will have solved the problems that got us here.
In spite of the complaints, Basel II appears to be moving forward. By October, the very largest U.S. banks, like Citigroup and Bank of America, have to show regulators how they plan to put Basel II in place. To find out how the finance world is preparing, I headed down to Wall Street. I found banker Rich Marin dining on calamari at Harry's Cafe.
Everybody's aware of it. So I think what you're seeing now is a lot of people making sure that their balance sheets are in as good a shape as they can be to meet those requirements.
But Marin admits Basel II's timing could be better. It may force banks to raise capital just when investors are shunning bank stocks.
It just makes it all that much more challenging because they are generally, not across the board, but generally more stringent capital rules. And it's coming at a time where capital is being impaired by the subprime crisis.
The banks don't have to ask shareholders for more money. They could simply stop taking so many risks. But that would mean lending less and putting an even bigger squeeze on the economy. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, going into debt isn't the only thing awaiting the college bound.
You will make lasting friends, including perhaps the love of your life. You will drink more than you ever thought possible and bitterly regret it in the morning. You will lose your virginity if you happen to have brought it with you.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks lumbered into bear market territory today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials plunged almost 1.5% or 166 points to close at 11,215. The Nasdaq tumbled 2.3% or 53 points to finish at 2251. The S&P 500 fell 1.8% or 23 points to end the day at 1261. Americans aren't traveling, and that's driving rental car companies into the red. Avis Budget Group skidded 22% after the number three rental car company offered a bleak earnings outlook. That let the air out of the tires for the entire sector. Hertz Global Holdings choked down 16%. Dollar Thrifty Automotive Group skidded 38%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for June. UFO enthusiasts converge on Roswell, New Mexico for the city's annual UFO Festival. A costume contest is among the many entertainment and educational events planned. Whether it increases Earth's chances of receiving alien visitors remains to be seen. And we enter a popular time to run air conditioners. Welcome to the dog days of summer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. The Labor Department releases its June unemployment tally tomorrow. Economists expect the jobless rate to fall slightly from 5.5% down to 5.4%. But job losses are also expected to continue. So what accounts for the discrepancy? The number of teenagers looking for summer jobs. Commentator and economist Robert Reich would like to suggest some summer work for Congress.
The economy is failing, but it's now clear the Fed won't revive it. It figures if it cuts interest rates, global investors will move their money out of dollars, causing the dollar to drop further, meaning more inflation as the price of everything we buy from the rest of the world, including much of our oil, rises even faster. Yet American consumers cannot stimulate the economy on their own because they don't have any money left. And exports can't make up the difference. So how do we get back on track? Blue Dog Democrats, Calvin Coolidge Republicans, and Ross Perot Independents all must understand the critical importance of a fiscal stimulus right now. And it has to be on the right scale. Distributing those little stimulus checks last month was like dispensing aspirin for pneumonia, momentary relief for a whole system desperately sick. The fastest and strongest stimulus would be a one-year exemption of the first $15,000 of income from payroll taxes, starting as soon as the bill is signed. Congress still has time to pass this before the session ends. This should be followed soon after the next president is sworn in by major infrastructure spending based on a newly formed capital budget. Expand public transportation, fix 100-year-old sewer and water systems, rebuild levees, invest in green technologies. All this will get the economy moving and bring it into the 21st century. But to keep the economy moving, the middle class will need to get back some of the buying power it's lost over the years, as almost all of the benefits of growth have gone to the very wealthy. The surest way is through a middle class tax cut, financed by a tax increase on those at the top. In other words, now that the Fed's hands are tied, we need a bold fiscal policy, a stimulus large enough to get the economy moving again, and a progressive tax system large enough to keep it moving. The question is how low the economy will have to sink before there's political will to do this.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Your thoughts? You'll find a contact link at marketplace.org. As if you couldn't tell already by the other stories in our lineup today, the economy continues to tread on shaky ground. Seems everybody's hurting. And though the rich aren't exactly getting richer, it's poor and middle-class families that are really feeling the pinch as food costs rise and credit gets tight. Author Barbara Ehrenreich once went undercover to find out how the working class got by, or as she states, did not get by, in America. That book was called Nickel and Dimed. Ehrenreich's written several others on the topic of the haves and have-nots in this country, and she's got a new collection of essays out. It's called This Land Is Their Land. Welcome.
Glad to be with you, Bob.
You've written about the economically downtrodden for years now. Why this book at this point?
Well, this is just a harvesting of all sorts of blogs and columns I've written in recent years that tend to be on these issues of economic inequality, economic injustice. And I didn't design it to come out just as the economy was tanking, though.
Well, you write a letter of sorts to young people entering college, sort of telling them what to expect. Can you read a few lines of that for us?
Okay, this is just a little sample of it's an essay called Fresh Persons, Welcome to Debt. Many life-changing things will happen to you in the next 4 years. You will make lasting friends, including perhaps the love of your life. You will drink more than you ever thought possible and bitterly regret it in the morning. You will lose your virginity if you happen to have brought it with you. Our stellar faculty ardently hopes that along the way you will be amazed by calculus and charmed by the tipsy conversations between Alcibiades and that wily old radical Socrates. There is also a general expectation that you will come out of here with some hazy notions of spelling and grammar. But never forget that your real purpose here is to shake off the pointless freedom of youth and assume the burden of debt.
Now, okay, let's pull you out of the satire and have you tell us, where do you think the preparation of young people for fiscal health stands in this country?
They're not doing a very good job. I mean, we're told that you have to get a college degree to enter into the white-collar workforce, but those college degrees are going to leave you with an average of over $20,000 in debt. So that's not a good start for a working life or for a successful life of any kind.
We just heard that consumer confidence is at an all-time low. What are you hearing from people out there who you're talking to?
A lot of alarm, approaching almost panic. And this is of people doing quite well, who have been quite affluent, all the way to people who have been struggling all along. It's just coming from too many directions at once. I mean, it's the retired couple who was counting on selling that house, but now there's no equity in that house, or less and less. It's the young people right out of college who have this big debt but can't find jobs. I talked to truck drivers who've been involved in recent protests about the cost of diesel fuel. It's just getting worse and worse and worse for them. And we depend on them to bring us 70% of the stuff we consume.
In all the research that you've done and talking to people, did you see this coming? How long has this been developing?
Well, I guess you could say I'd like to take credit, okay? I saw it coming. But, you know, for a long time, people said, all right, we're a very unequal society. A lot of, you know, we've got a huge amount of wealth at the top. We've got all this poverty, insecure middle class. So what? That's just how it is. Well, it turned out that it doesn't work. And the reason it ultimately didn't work as of a year ago and all the problems that have ensued since the credit meltdown is that, you know, you have so many poor people, they can't buy stuff. They can't pay their debts. And when they started defaulting on houses in August of 2007, you know, that set off global economic financial turmoil anyway. It caught up with us. We found out that having this degree of inequality is in fact a liability, and not just from the point of view of the poor.
So where do we go from here, do you think? Is it just going to get worse, or is there any ray of hope out there?
Well, I think first of all, things will get worse probably for a while. But the ray of hope for me was that we had, certainly on the Democratic side this last spring, three candidates who were speaking quite truthfully, I thought, about economic issues, about the growing inequality, about the real crisis for the middle class. And those were Obama, Clinton, and Edwards. And that was not true in 2004. That was not true in 2000. That says to me there's been a sea change.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of the new book, This Land Is Their Land. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Bob.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments. A prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, have you ever tried to figure out the coins in your pocket only by feel? U.S. coins are distinguishable by their size and weight, but now a prototype of the first ever Braille dollar coin has been unveiled. It's due out next spring to commemorate the 200th anniversary of the birth of Louis Braille, who created the alphabet for the blind. The coin was introduced at the annual convention of the National Federation of the Blind in Dallas. The U.S. Mint will produce 400,000 of the commemorative coins, which will be available at a $10 surcharge. The sales will benefit programs to help the blind. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 166 points, 1.5%. The Nasdaq lost 53 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 fell 22 points, 1.75%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Cologne, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Next time on the program, the import-export business feels the pinch.
This is the first year in 5 years I haven't traveled to Europe to do on a buying trip. And my dollar's so weak, I'm dependent on what I can get in the U.S. right now.
I'm Bob Moon. We're depending on you to join us again here tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.